Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm David Andrews. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. This episode was recorded at the National Security College's Securing Our Future conference on the 9th of April, 2024, as a panel discussion between Richard Maud, Executive Director of Asia Society Australia, Greg Moriarty, Secretary of the Department of Defence, Dr. Huang Lei Tu, Asia Deputy Director for the International Crisis Group, and Richard Fontaine, CEO of the Centre for a New American Security. This conversation was chaired by Professor Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College. In the weeks to come, we will be releasing more content from the conference on our channels, so please subscribe to the podcast, our YouTube channel, or follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn to receive the latest updates. We hope you enjoyed this session recording.
Great to be back, and it's great to have such a full house for this really important session of the conference. So this is the first in our set of concurrent sessions, and this, I guess, is the strategic conversation. So we're looking at Indo-Pacific and global security, but particularly in the Indo-Pacific context. This session is about Indo-Pacific statecraft and really bringing together the dimensions of deterrence, diplomacy, and perhaps some other levers or arms of statecraft as well, with the core objective being how do we maintain stability and peace in the Indo-Pacific region? How do we manage the risks? How do we prevent coercion from being effective? How do we prevent coercion from escalating to conflict? There's so much to cover. We've got four fantastic speakers who've been very generous in making time to be here today. We have speakers who are not only experts in their field, but obviously leading practitioners and who don't need much introduction. So I'll just very briefly remind us that we have, just starting to my immediate right, we have Richard Maud. Richard Maud is currently Executive Director of Asia Society Australia, but also, of course, a leader in the Australian national security community in many roles throughout the years. We have Greg Moriarty, the Secretary of Defence. We have Dr. Huang Lei Tu, and Huang is now the Asia Deputy Director for International Crisis Group and is known to many of you from her academic career. And I'm very pleased that all the way from the United States, Richard Fontaine, the Chief Executive Officer of the Centre for a New American Security, has joined us. I'll invite each of the four panellists just to give us some brief framing remarks on how they see not only the challenges of the strategic environment in the Indo-Pacific, but how they see this idea of integrated statecraft, of bringing together deterrence and diplomacy and more, how it's working, whether in the Australian context or whether in the efforts of other countries to really preserve peace, stability, and the conditions for prosperity in the Indo-Pacific. And with that, I'm going to throw the ball straight to Richard Maud for your opening thoughts.
Well, thank you, Rory. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. And it's a pleasure to be speaking today in such distinguished company. This is a very big subject. We could come at it in a number of ways, but I thought just to get us going, I would cue from the two questions that are in the session blurb, and one of those, Rory's, is your last point about how are we going in integrating deterrence and diplomacy and other elements of statecraft. Well, it's a work in progress and probably always will be, but I think there is pretty notable progress nonetheless. I mean, certainly from my perspective now as someone who watches rather than participate. So I think the last couple of years have seen more ambition and more progress in Australia on integrating deterrence and diplomacy than we've seen before. The government, of course, now frames foreign and defence policy as interdependent components of a strategy to build Australia's influence and support regional stability. The government says that foreign policy builds regional resilience and deterrence guards against aggression and coercion, not just of us, but also of our neighbours. And when it comes to military deterrence, the government's pretty clear that Australia must and will do its part. Now, this is a narrative that's now pretty consistent in the way the government talks about Australia's approach to the Indo-Pacific, but I think importantly, it's also been matched now in Canberra by frameworks, by systems, by ways of working that support policy design and the delivery of policy in an all arms of statecraft model. The Defence Strategic Review is a good example of this, particularly for its emphasis on embedding a new approach to defence within a broader strategy that harnesses all elements of national power when we approach the region. And presumably we'll see this idea carried forward in the National Defence Strategy, which we expect to see soon. So overall, there's now a great deal of this kind of integrated Australian policy geared towards supporting a favourable regional balance or a strategic equilibrium are the two ways that the government tends to talk about what we would like to see in this part of the world. The second question in the session blurb is, well, how's it going? And in particularly, what more can be done? Well, on the what more can be done, no doubts, lots. This is a long contest, a long struggle in the Indo-Pacific of uncertain prospects, and we need to think about it as a generational endeavour. We need to gear for that kind of long-term test of our ability to work in the region. There's lots that could be said here, but just let me offer three quick thoughts. First, on deterrence, there's now, as Greg can tell you, an awful lot on defence's books. So the task now is consistency on what we want from the Australian Defence Force, including across future governments, and then delivery, delivery, and delivery. Much of the capability we want that goes to deterrence is, with the best will in the world, some years away. So we simply can't keep changing our minds about what we expect of the Defence Force. We should also, and when thinking about deterrence, we should not forget the economic component of deterrence. And that does require clear, coordinated and consistent messages by like-minded partners to China about the economic consequences, especially of any attempt to take Taiwan by force, not just from the global recession that would surely follow, but from the Western sanctions that would also follow. Just lastly on deterrence, this first of my three quick points. Deterrence is not going to be easy to manage. It creates a security dilemma with China. So deterrence can't be set and forget. And reassurance of China, which the government argues reasonably enough is a necessary companion to deterrence, is very hard because China really is not going to be convinced that the West is not out to contain it. Sorry for the double negative there, but hopefully that made sense. But we do need to try, and especially on Taiwan. A second point on where the gaps are or where can we do more. We still, like-minded partners, struggle to find convincing responses to some dimensions of China's behaviour in the region. Disinformation, of course, is a very hard one. Interference, the co-option of elites. And we are still, I think, struggling to find the right levers to influence China's grey zone coercion, notably around Taiwan and in the South China Sea, especially right now at Second Thomas Shoal, where there is a real test of everything that we say is important about the future of the region playing out in front of our eyes. And these are very hard nuts to crack, so we should feel empathy for policymakers grappling with them. but they do demand creative diplomacy and possibly at times taking on more risk. The third of my three quick points is that our deteriorating strategic circumstances are pushing us into a broader discussion about what resilience and what preparedness look like in an Australian context. And that's an important discussion. But in having that discussion, in thinking about the policy choices we make, there are going to be trade-offs between prosperity and security. That's been true for a little while, of course, when it comes to foreign investment, when it comes to critical infrastructure, when it comes to critical minerals, and now increasingly with some forms of technologies, even the technologies we know we need, for example, to power our clean energy transition. So these kinds of choices when it comes to resilience and economic security and preparedness are not going to get easier. They're going to keep coming at us. And we need pretty sophisticated frameworks for policy making, remembering that we're an open economy. As a nation, we're a capital importer, and we're a nation with a relatively small industrial base. So even though our interests are strongly aligned with those of the United States, they're not going to be identical. So, Rory, I'll stop there.
Look, thanks very much, Richard. Lots to think about there. And in the conversation, I'd love us to come back to explaining what strategic equilibrium actually means. I think it's great that you've raised economic deterrence, the grey zone, resilience and preparedness as well. Greg Moriarty, Secretary of Defence, over to you. What's your perspective?
Thanks, Rory. So, very, very much comfortable with the principles that Richard outlined. And I think for us, in terms of national defence and the government's national defence strategy, it does talk about integrated defence, integrated statecraft, and we certainly see that defence needs to be a contributor to Australian statecraft, all the way from, you know, sort of a diplomacy, the presence, the building, the shaping part of how we define it, through to deterrence and then potentially responding. But we are very comfortable that defence strategy needs to be nestled in that broader concept of Australian statecraft, that we will be, in many cases, led and contributing to other either departments or other parts of Australian society who are leading some of those initiatives. So I spend a lot of my week thinking about how we contribute to other departments and agencies and supporting the government's broader agenda. In the Pacific, for example, we contribute personnel but also many assets to the South Pacific strategy, which is led by the Office of the Pacific in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And that's a very close relationship. The government now has a Southeast Asia strategy, again, with a very big economic dimension to it. And the foreign minister's spoken about the importance of our economic strategy in Southeast Asia. So defence is, in many ways, sees itself as supporting that. But there is an edge to what we're doing, and we're looking at the Indo-Pacific region now through a different lens, where strategic competition, particularly between China and the United States, is now an enduring feature of our environment. It is of our time, and it is not going to change very quickly. So we do need to respond to that, and I think the government is seeking to do so. Achieving balance, a balance in which no one country dominates and all are free to make their choices and pursue their interests is sort of, I think, core to the Australian policy sort of framework. But what does that mean in terms of how you pursue your interests? For us, it means building and thickening out old partnerships, working on new ones and permutations, but it's certainly the government's view, defence's view, that the United States will be even more important to us, in a, particularly in a defence and a strategic sense, as we seek to achieve that balance and that equilibrium. So the United States alliance with Australia, but its multidimensional presence in the Indo-Pacific will continue to be really important. So will the relationships we're building with India, Japan, Vietnam, the entire ASEAN network. And that, for us in defence as well, it is often seen as primarily a foreign policy construct, but for us, ASEAN centrality also resonates in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of building patterns of cooperation and military exercises and operations with the member states of ASEAN. In the South Pacific, we want to be the security partner of choice, but it's not just about great power competition. We have to respond to the needs and the interests of the members of the Pacific Island Forum. That family-first approach only is going to succeed if they perceive that Australia, other players such as New Zealand, the United States, Japan, external powers, are interested in their genuine security concerns, and that often involves climate change and disaster resilience and response. So for us, building those networks are particularly important. But we need to be able to make an effective military contribution to deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. And for that, for us, that means being able to develop the capabilities and the operational skills to be able to hold an adversary at risk at longer ranges, including in the approaches to and to defend Australia. That is going to require a reshaping of the Australian Defence Force towards the development of longer range capabilities, moving away from a balanced force towards a focused force that is focused on those things. But the government will still require us to be able to continue to make a contribution to a global rules-based order. That remains a mission, even though the focus will be laser-like on the Indo-Pacific region. We need to be able to develop the capabilities that make a potential adversary change its risk calculus. And that means a judgment that it will not be able to secure its military objectives or its overall objectives through the use of force. We need to develop more of those capabilities in a self-reliant way, but we also need to build them in concert with others. We have the alliance with the United States remains central to our capacity to grow that capability and to operate in the region. But having those capabilities, we also feel, contributes to a region in which deterrence is real. There's no point in simply trying to build norms and conventions if there is no possible risk that breaching those norms or conventions doesn't have a price. So I think government's very clear-eyed about the need for the order to provide opportunities for all countries, including China, to achieve its objectives through peaceful means and by following the rules and the norms. But we are very focused on the need to provide a deterrent capability, both for ourselves in terms of our narrow defence of Australia capabilities, but we want to make a positive contribution to regional balance, regional equilibrium and deterrence. And I think that's where the government's national defence strategy went very strongly, and I'm very confident when it's announced in a few weeks' time that the next national defence strategy will reinforce those themes. I'll leave it there, Rory.
We'll be right back.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row?
Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Look, thank you, Greg, and I think that again opens up some really interesting lines of conversation. I'm sure that somewhere in the room, if it's not on this panel, there'll be the obvious question about AUKUS and the recent speculation about Japan. But I think it would be interesting to get a little bit more specific insight into what those capabilities are for deterrence. We'll come back to that in a moment. I'm going to go now to Huang. Welcome.
Thank you, Rory. May I start with thanking you and everyone involved in the conference for inviting me, and especially on this very esteemed panel. Rory asked me to add some to the conversation, some perspective from Australia's near neighbours, which is Southeast Asia. And I would start by saying that we talk about deterrence in a very prominent conversations here, or very developed conversation in the US. But in Southeast Asia, the understanding and concept of deterrence is very different than the conversations happening here. First of all, I'm not very convinced that everybody is on board with deterrence, and I'll explain why. Of course, I agree with Richard that the situation is very fluid, it is changing, and then we can assess the response to, for example, the coercion in the Second Thomas Shoal as evolving strategies to deterrence. But let me start with the definition, and then I'll explain why different countries in Southeast Asia adopt different policies. You can tell that I have academic background if I start with a definition, right? But there is a formula for an effective deterrence, which is to have capability times will and times communication, which means if you are wanting to have an effective deterrence, you have to have means to do it, military capability starting with. But then you have to have will to use it. And you have to be able to communicate it beforehand. And so it's a long-term process. It is evolving all parts of governments, including foreign affairs, and in terms of when strategy communication is very important and first and foremost. But then if the definition of deterrence tend to put more emphasis on the capability in building the effective force, then I'm not convinced that it is unified adopted in Southeast Asia. Why? Because even when it comes to, having capability to deter adversaries, right? Unwanted action from adversary. But in Southeast Asia, even adversary is not unified agreed on. Not even the whole region, but even sometimes within one country. So who do you deter in the first place? What is your goal in the first place, right? And deterrence is costly. It's very costly. It is, except for Singapore, who is advanced economically and really punches above its weight when it comes to military capability. Most of the rest of the region self-identify as developing countries and have often say that they have other priorities, including development, mostly development. So it is the decisions that the nations have to take in Southeast Asia, and it requires resources that not necessarily everyone wants to spend. And oftentimes, military capability build up or modernization in the Southeast Asian region is not necessarily to address external threat. Oftentimes it is also to address internal instabilities. Now, but there are also different facets of deterrence. If we're talking about deterrence is a way to control escalation or encourage restraint or present, provide assurance or reassurance to partners and allies, then in that context, I would actually grade Southeast Asian deterrence pretty high. They've been doing it for a long time. And mind you, that ASEAN framework that Greg mentioned was first and foremost created to prevent escalation of conflict in between neighbors. So if you assess it that way, and in long-term perspective, I think Southeast Asian deterrence is doing pretty okay. You know, regardless how what you think about the current state of ASEAN centrality and effectiveness in responding to security crisis. But if you look at a longer picture, I think this is something we can learn a lot from as well. Now, and all this ASEAN diplomacy, it's not just about summits, leaders' retreats and golf to self-reassure, but there are other also forms of diplomacy, including so-called coercive diplomacy or responding with coercive diplomacy to coercive diplomacy. That is also one of the tools that sometimes, not often, but sometimes countries also adopt. For example, Vietnam has done that in the past when it faced coercion from China in the South China Sea. Philippines, now under Marcos Jr., is adopting so-called assertive transparency, which is shedding light to all the activities in the gray zone sphere that comes from the Chinese provocation, for example. So there is a great deal, and I won't have the time to go through all the Southeast Asian strategies, but I think it is very natural for Southeast Asia to adopt that dual approach, deterrence and diplomacy. In fact, for example, Singapore states in its national strategy that is a dual key pillars for national security, which is deterrence and diplomacy. And you know, Singapore being small, but it adopts poisonous shrimp strategy, and no one wants to be having a poisonous shrimp, right? Mm-hmm. And also, its diplomacy is so effective, it is not even conceivable for anyone, even those that Singapore may deem as a potential threat, to really have any actions that would be impinging on Singapore's sovereignty. Because being in good relations, in diplomatic relations, trading with Singapore is much more beneficial than otherwise. And even Vietnam, once upon a time, quite a feisty country, is now learning from its neighbors that bamboo diplomacy is reaping a lot of benefits, right? And Vietnam, mind you, that has been always, for a long time, working under the principle cooperating while struggling, cooperating with China while struggling to assert its, for example, national sovereignty in the South China Sea claims. So in that regard, I think I would say that not only diplomacy and deterrence, but actually deterrence through diplomacy when we talk about Southeast Asian countries, and it can be done in a relatively peaceful time. What happens in the wartime or more regional wartime is another story. But I wanted to just close up my remarks by suggesting to Australia, knowing this context, what is important for the region, being its next door neighbor and wanted to be also a partner of choice, which is, yes, I think it is valued that Australia is ramping up its defense diplomacy, deterrence capability. Diplomacy is a very important part, which both Richard and Greg explained. But I would add the third one, which is development. And as I mentioned in the opening remark, most of the regions self-define themselves as a developing countries, and therefore development goals will be still at the top priority. And so if we want to succeed even more, we must not forget about that. I'll stop here.
Look, thank you, Hoang. And I think several questions that your thoughtful remarks raise. I think coercive diplomacy. What are some examples of that? We might come back to that. This concept of assertive transparency that the Philippines has been adopting. The model of competing while or cooperating while competing or cooperating while struggling. And finally, the question about development. We may come back before the end of the conversation to whether, in fact, development assistance is itself a tool of strategic competition or indeed deterrence, or whether that's the wrong conversation. But let me now go to Richard Fontaine. Richard, as a practitioner, but also now as a super analyst and the leader of a think tank, how do you from Washington see the deterrence and diplomacy picture in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, thanks, Rory. Thanks for having me. Congratulations to you and to the National Security College for this gathering that you've put together here, which is quite impressive, and for all the other impressive work that you guys have been doing. I think it's worth starting by asking, what is it that we're trying to deter in the first place? And the answer, I think, is a few things. We're trying to deter upheaval in the regional order, broadly construed. We're trying to deter the expansion of illiberal values or interference in our democracies. We're trying to deter the use of economic tools of coercion against our economies. But overall, we're trying to deter war in the Indo-Pacific. And that is critical, and it's a critical starting point, because war in the Indo-Pacific, if it were to involve China, if it would involve certainly the U.S. and China, could be catastrophic on a scale that we have not seen for, thankfully, for many decades. And so the priority in deterring that war in the first place is quite high. Deterrence, of course, is, in that context, Beijing believing that it is not ready for a successful military operation, that it wouldn't be successful in carrying one out and achieving its objectives, or that the cost of carrying out that objective would be unacceptably high. And so in either case, they refrain from engaging in the military activity in the first place. Much of the activity over the past couple of years, explicitly or implicitly, has been aimed at increasing deterrence. And fundamentally, this turns on stronger allies working more closely together and doing so in visible ways that convey a message of capability and will to use that capability if necessary. So some of the things that are quite obvious, AUKUS bringing increased capability in the region, including nuclear-propelled subs, but also some of the Pillar 2 capabilities. Some of the force posture changes. President Marcos is in Washington right now, but the United States has gotten more access to bases and things in the Philippines. Prime Minister Kishida is in Washington right now as well, where there'll be some announcements about increasing the operating ability of the U.S.-Japan alliance in some rather concrete ways. And so you look around the region at some of the changes that have taken place, both in terms of the operational nature of the alliances and on force posture. Then you have the strengthening of allies on their own. I would argue that Japan's change of defense policy today is probably the most significant security development in the Indo-Pacific anywhere. The doubling of its defense budget, the acquisition of long-range strike capabilities, the participation in various arrangements around the region and so forth. And that brings the next element of this, which is that all of us have to adequately resource our security capabilities and develop new concepts that address what has been a deteriorating military balance in the region over the past decade or so. And I think, finally, we need to understand that deterrence crosses regions. There's something of a debate in Washington about whether all this aid that's going to Ukraine is ultimately a big distraction from the ability to preserve deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. You know, we're the United States has provided many billions of dollars in various forms of aid, including military aid to Ukraine. There's a $60 billion request sitting before the U.S. Congress right now. Some people will say, well, you know, we should save those resources, sort of let the Europeans figure it all out on their own, or maybe the Ukrainians can do something by themselves. But this is ultimately a distraction and a diversion of critical and scarce national security resources away from the region that matters most, which is the Indo-Pacific, and from the priority that matters most, which is dealing with China. I think that's wrong. And I think one hears that that's wrong probably even more loudly in this region than in Washington. And I think that's important, because had the United States and Australia and the West at the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine done nothing, that would have been bad. But the fact that we've come as far as we have and said that the things that Russia has done in Ukraine are unacceptable, and that we will stick with Ukraine for as long as it takes to bring the lesson to anyone, including the next would-be aggressor potentially in this region, that if you want some sort of territorial acquisition, just wait out the West. Maybe it'll take 2 years, maybe it'll take 3 years, but hunker down and you get to keep what you got. That's a terrible message when it comes to preserving deterrence in this region. So that's on the deterrence side. I'll just close by saying, you know, the flip side of the coin, of course, is diplomacy. And I think that the premium on high-level diplomacy, especially with China, is very significant, particularly as we're engaged in deterrence, because almost by definition, a lot of the activities that we're going to be engaged in, particularly in the military areas, are going to heighten tensions with China. The diplomacy is not going to resolve the underlying competitive dynamic in the Indo-Pacific, but it can establish channels of communication and be helpful in diffusing crises, or hopefully avoiding them in the first place. So it's this combination of enhanced deterrence and enhanced diplomacy that I think have to go hand in hand.
Thank you, Richard. And I'm glad you've brought not only Ukraine and the global dynamic into the picture. The reference to Japan is important as well. We do have Admiral Takai speaking this afternoon, so there will be a Japanese perspective on this elsewhere in the conference. Look, it's been a really illuminating, dynamic start, I think, to the conversation, pretty forthright as well. And along the way, as well as looking at deterrence and diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific, I think we had something of a potted masterclass on Australian machinery of government, which is actually incredibly useful for our consideration of national security and future strategy. So please join me in thanking our panel.
Thank you for listening to the National Security Podcast. For the full session recording, including the Q&A, please visit our YouTube channel.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.